Welcome to our series of shows about mental health in association with Lambeth Public Health, with me, Sinai Flary, and my co-host, Patrick Vernon. On today's show, we will be discussing Black men and their mental well-being.
Colourful.
Lambeth colourful, Mental colourful, Health Radio Show.
Colourful Radio.
Our guests in the studio today are from Black Thrive, so I would ask them to introduce themselves for our listeners.
Hi, my name is Siddiqui Harris. I'm the communications lead for Black Thrive.
And my name is Nathan Lewis, and I'm one of the facilitators for this project.
Okay, firstly, can you tell our listeners about Black Thrive and what sort of services you offer?
Well, the quick answer is that Black Thrive doesn't offer any services. We're a facilitation team. So Black Thrive is a mental health partnership that exists within Lambeth that looks to address some of the inequalities that exist around mental health and Black people's involvement in mental health within the borough.
So hi there, both of you, Siddiqui and Nathan. And obviously I worked with you in terms of Black Thrive. So, and obviously the work is really important in Lambeth. I mean, we're exploring the issue around Black men and mental health. And you're actually doing a particular project, aren't you?
Yeah.
Working with Black men, straight and LGBT.
Correct.
As well. Do you want to just talk briefly about the work of Black Thrive? Well, maybe initially, Siddiqui, because we've had lots of conversations about Black identity, Black masculinity, Black fatherhood. Just what's your take on the issues around Black men and mental health from your perspective?
From Siddiqui Harris's perspective, sure. Well, I think there's a lot of issues when it comes to Black men and even talking about mental health. One of the biggest problems, like you said, is identity, and that's not necessarily about like some of the things that come up in terms of intersectionality and all this kind of stuff. This is even like some of the literature that we're reading. You know, you want to do a project on Black men's health and you're going to be using statistics from the States. Now, although the issues over there are similar, in Britain, in Black Britain, as I say, we've got a completely different set of principles, how we do things. So it's very difficult to, you know, navigate this platform, this area when it comes to Black mental health. But I do think that, you know, there is a lot of issues that we have and we need to address them, but we need to start being more creative in our thinking and being a bit more braver in terms of innovations and trying to do new things in order to solve our problems.
That makes sense. So from your perspective, what are the key issues around mental health and Black men?
The key issues, I mean, it's even due to my involvement with Black Thrive, what I've realised is that even the things that I thought about initially have just been thrown aside. It comes in so many different ways. You know, like Patrick mentioned, fatherhood. I'm a member of a father support group, and even some of these Black men that you see that are broken, they're broken because they've lost their families, relationships. Sometimes it's about employment. Sometimes it's about not having no money, not having anywhere to go. Ultimately, what I've learned so far, especially with this project, is that isolation in the Black community is a massive problem. And I think ultimately, somehow, I get the impression, because obviously I'm an 80s baby, so I feel like there was more community possibly in the 60s and the 70s or in the 50s, you know, that Windrush generation.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they had mental health issues like how we've got mental health issues now. But I feel like over time there's been I don't know if it's erosion a word?
Mm. But or like a breakdown.
A breakdown, that's better. Of community, and I think now this is why we're seeing the numbers like how we're seeing, and especially impacting that is stuff like, you know, like social media, and again this idea of identity, who am I? Again, in Black Britain, I think we actually struggle to even tell our story more times than not. We actually don't realize that I feel like we have a unique relationship. I mean, here we are at Colourful Radio, Colourful African. I can see it on the wall. For me, I always say, like, if you honestly believe that Africa is the motherland, for example, now let's say it's a drum and it's beating a drum. If you understand how sound works, in Britain, we're actually closer to that original sound, that original drum pattern, than America is. So I think it's very strange that often a lot of our ideas around Africa or blackness actually comes from a place that's vibrationally quite a lot further than we are. And I think if we actually just focused on what was going on here and did more stuff here, then I think we'd find that some of these issues we're facing would just disappear, to be honest.
Nathan, I want to bring you in. You're nodding in agreement there with Siddiqui. Is that something that you also agree with?
I do from my aspect. So I do quite a bit of work looking at sexual health and mental health within, well, I would say predominantly black gay spaces. So I've worked with organisations like House of Rainbow, Blackout, and recently I've been going to the States. I've been able to go to Nigeria and do sexual health interventions there. And I realised that actually there isn't much of a difference. And that sometimes we do focus a bit too much looking at America. I think the issues there, they're similar, but they're really different. And oftentimes we look to there for a solution where really we should look closer to home.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm definitely completely in agreement there.
Mm. I think that's something that we haven't really discussed in terms of like the whole mental health issue in the black community, is this idea of feeling kind of like lost or without a home. Like we're in Britain, we have our identity, but yet still we're not fully accepted in British society. But then if we take a holiday, say to wherever our parents are from as well, we're also seen as like foreigners. So I feel like that could also have an impact on our mental health at some point, like feeling like we don't really belong anywhere.
Yeah, it's funny because I got Winston Churchill Travel Award, and I went to the Caribbean and I went to America to find, trying to explore. If you go to the Caribbean, I went to Jamaica and Barbados, and then I went to the States to look at issues around black culture, and did that, was that like an anchor around our mental well-being? I mean, obviously it's, the answer is yes, but it has different manifestations, as you both have articulated. But what was interesting is, and I've been involved in lots of campaigns and stuff around history and heritage over the years, is even now, we're still kind of questioning who we are and belonging, because we are told every single day by the state and mainstream bodies that you don't belong here, either subconsciously or consciously. And so we have to create this anchor, whereas at least with African-Americans, they know, you know, they said we're African-American, and we could be Republican, we could be Democrat, we could be straight or gay, but we're African-American. Whereas in Britain, because of, as you said, Siddiqui, we're closer to the continent, and the history of migration is different compared to America. We have multiple identities.
Yeah.
And the question is, you know, the densities reflect. Yeah, you might say, yeah, I'm very proud of my Jamaican or Bayesian or Trinidad roots one day. I'm very proud to be of my African roots the next day. I'm very proud to be a South Londoner the next day.
Yep.
Or Arsenal supporter the next day. Yep. So it kind of varies, isn't it?
It does. And I think it can have an impact, to be honest. We don't have this one. But I think it kind of, you know, I'm a believer in like crisis and opportunity. I think they're the exact same thing, to be fair. And I do think that we are at a point where we can create any future we wanted to, really and truly, if we put in the work. You know, because there is this massive question mark over, well, what are black people in Britain and who they are? And you can kind of see this on some of the television shows, some of the things that, you know, the amazing Patrick Vernon has put forward and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. You can kind of see it. So I think we do have this question mark, and I think with the right minds and the right work and the right activities, we can answer that question. And then possibly this could help solve some of the massive mental health issues that we have within the community. I mean, Black Thrive is just Lambeth, but you know, the issues, because I'm the comms lead, I get emails from up and down the country. Mm. You understand? Asking, well, can you do something here? When are you coming there? Do you understand? The problems are up and down Britain. It's not just Lambeth.
Yeah. I mean, how do you think the attitudes towards mental health have evolved in the black community over the years? And what do you think still needs to be improved or worked upon? And that's for both of you.
I'll go first in a few different aspects. So one thing, I'm a pastor's grandchild. I'm exposing myself here. but I've been able to do some really, really great work with Southwark Council, looking at how to apply public health thoughts and initiatives in faith groups. I'm a very, very big proponent of looking at where our communities are, where we lie, what we rely on, and faith mm-hmm. is still one of those things. And I really do put a huge onus on faith groups to actually look and see how well that they support their communities. Prayer is great, but action is better. Mm. And I think oftentimes people talk about spiritual abuse. You know, a lot of people, whether right or wrong way, and that's your opinion, refer to things if, you know, you're doing all these things and relate it to demonic possession. That might be true, depending on your belief system, but I'm very much a believer of looking at practical things.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that I'd probably say, just from a sexuality standpoint, is just I'm an 80s baby as well. And you spoke a lot about social isolation and loneliness. And I would say that has had such a massive impact in the community. I think for a lot of people, they're still coming out of HIV, you know, the epidemics and the thoughts and the fears. And that still strikes fear into a lot of people's minds. Just thinking about, we're talking about Lambeth and some of the work that I do, people have been saying that I'm in Lambeth and I don't feel safe. I can't be who I want to be. I don't know if when I walk outside my house, I'm going to be a victim of hate crime. I have to pretend to be somebody else. I can't go to the barbershop for fear of being exposed or what they're going to say to me. And all of those things cumulatively have such a massive impact on mental well-being. So for me, those are some of the things I would say. Feeling safe, being able to express yourself, being able to be who you are. And just in terms of identity... Mm. That is so complex. I would describe myself as being British born, Caribbean background, African descent. But for somebody else, that might be so complicated.
You're messing the census now.
But
extra boxes.
That makes complete sense to me. And I feel a complete peace when I say that. I recognize that I'm of African descent. I'm proud to my parents from Jamaica and St. Kitts. But at the end of the day, I was born here. If I go there, they're going to call me English.
Mm. English.
Yeah.
Foreigner.
Yeah. But my passport says that I'm from there. Yeah. So let's just get that straight.
Yeah, I mean, just kind of support what Nathan's saying. The other day, Black Five was asked to join another organization called Dazzle. I'm not even too sure what Dazzle do. It was a hope event around hate crime in the borough, and you know, I wasn't even too aware that we had certain issues like what Nathan was saying. But at that, I was like, you know, people getting beaten up for whatever they are, and you know, it's really bad, to be fair. And I do believe that too will impact the psychological thinking behavior of individuals. So I think when it comes to the black perspective, what I think is that, you know, a lot more, in my opinion, Siddiqui Harris's opinion, a lot more education needs to take place, and, you know, a lot more reading and understanding that, you know, first of all, we're not this one homogenous group, and actually that's something that was put on us by outsiders, really and truly, because we know, you know, even if you look at, let's say you can look at somewhere like Nigeria, for example. I don't know how many languages they speak just in Nigeria alone, or how many different types of people there are. But, you know, it's the numbers are high. So we always knew that we are not one homogenous group. Therefore, if we're not one homogenous group, one solution cannot be, you know, one solution can't just be the answer to everybody's problems. You got people, Black Thrive has kind of shown me that you've got people who are totally against pharmaceutical use, and we do agree that there is an over prescription or there is an overuse of prescription drugs on black people. The statistics say that.
Yeah.
However, to just have a blanket no to pharmaceuticals, what people need to realize is that everyone's an individual, and subjectivity or subjectiveness, whatever, everyone's individual. So what works for me may not possibly work for you, mm-hmm. and that's okay. What we have to be is okay to we have to be okay in understanding that everybody can find their own solutions, and ultimately that's fine.
Yeah,
you know.
So just want to explore a bit about the project you're working with. Yeah. People use this expression, the pipeline. They usually often use that pipeline for young people, 13, 14, then they get into prison.
Mm.
Is there a pipeline emerging around the whole stuff around mental health where young people, teenagers, or eventually by the time they're 20s, they're in the Maudsley, in the Meme Secure Unit, or somewhere else? Is there a pipeline emerging from what you see from the work of Black Thrive and the work that you've been doing, Nathan, as well?
I think I'm going to be honest, and I think I do believe that there is a type of pipeline coming and emerging. And again, for me, this is just us copying. You know, there's a silly saying that if America coughs, Britain catches a cold. Yeah. And I hate that saying, because I work very hard not to catch a cold anytime. So I don't see why we're catching these colds. However, you know, one of the problems that, like I was even expressing to Nathan, was that even with the project, so we decided to have one of the projects at a barbershop in Stockwell. And while I was out there promoting across the, because it's a Lambeth-wide initiative, we wanted anyone from Lambeth to join, any young black man. There were people at like the north of the borough, bishops, these are different wards and all this kind of stuff, saying that they can't go to Stockwell. And I'm like, what do you mean you can't go to Stockwell? You understand? But they can't go to Stockwell because of fear of serious youth violence and this kind of stuff. And for me, this is just, it's really sad to see. Do you understand? Because I know I'm not Lambeth born, but I'm Lambeth bred. So I know there was a time when I could go anywhere in Lambeth that I wanted. Do you understand? There was no problems. So for young men to be saying that, yeah, they can't come Stockwell, for me, that was a big problem. And I think there's also a problem around drug misuse as well. I'm seeing a lot of young guys smoking. You know what I mean? I didn't smoke until I was like 19 years old. Do you know what I mean? And I'm seeing little 13-year-olds on the road bunning it down. So for me, I think this is all kind of adding to the problem that we're seeing. And also, again, with the impact of, I grew up in an area where there wasn't social media, even like the mobile phone, really and truly. You know, I was explaining to my daughter the other day that there was actually a time where if you weren't home, you weren't home. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You ain't going to catch me. You know, if the phone rang, it was in the house. That was it.
Yeah.
But now we are in this culture where we're always connected. And I am worried that these kind of factors are helping to build said pipeline, you know.
I would say for me, just following what you said, Siddiqui, I grew up in an area where it wasn't uncommon to see people smoking at 10, 12, 13. Mm. So for me, I feel like that pipeline's already been in existence. My question is, I feel like trauma has already been building up. I think I've worked in mental health wards. I've grown up seeing people that I went to school with, college with, just coming in and recognizing me as a face that's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's already in existence for me. I think it's more about I'm quite solution focused. So I can only think, how can we cut the pipeline or reduce it? And what we can do looking internally within our community. I think we were having a discussion actually about whether psychosocial interventions here in this country, whether they're actually for us, Siddiqui brought it up, and whether there is a need for us to start looking at more African or black-centered approaches to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, are they do people know about them? Do we want to know about them? And how effective are they? because we're speaking about over-prescription. And I would need to do further research on whether the effectiveness of CBT and other therapies and on how they support us and support our needs.
Yeah. Maybe, I mean, maybe I'm just trying to not paint a real picture like how Nathan is in terms of you seeing people smoking at 10 and all of this stuff. I do think the community is also dealing with some traumas, community, which we call, at Black Fabric, call community traumas. Mm-hmm. And these are, you know, stories. I mean, again, Lambeth is full of, you got the Cherry Gross incident, and you got Black Thrive is built because of what happened with Sean Rigg. Mm-hmm. But these stories are all over the borough. I mean, and the community itself hasn't healed. Mm-hmm. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is something that Black people just kind of bought into, but in Britain, you have this idea that you have the stiff upper lip and you don't show emotion, and you know, and maybe we've just adopted something that's actually just not worked for us. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the community maybe haven't healed because we haven't had justice? So it's like these issues and these problems that we've seen, whether it be, you know, the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, whether it be the death of Sean Rigg, you know, we haven't had full closure. We haven't had justice, so we can't rest. So we can't really forget about it. It's always on our mind. Whether we come to Brixton and we see some graffiti saying justice for Sean Rigg, it's never really going to go away. And for me, feeling like there's a constant issue there that hasn't been addressed, I'm wondering, how can you ever properly heal from it?
Yeah, I'm smiling because yesterday I was chilling with this Rasta guy, and the idea of justice came up, and he said, there's no such thing as justice. There's just us. And, you know, and I actually think that it's one of the problems that we have in the community. We are waiting for this thing, like certain things to heal us. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to be a bit more, like Nathan said initially, it's more about action.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, prayer, spirit, you know, prayer is good, waiting for somebody else to help you, but we have to be able to help ourselves. And I think if we helped ourselves a bit more, then we wouldn't feel like justice isn't being served. Once you understand that actually, you know, you can kind of help yourself here, you know, and certain things have to happen. You know, we do want to see police go to jail, for example, when you murder somebody from the community in terms of like how what happened with like or kill or when somebody dies in police custody. Mm-hmm. Let me not try to get sued here. We do want to see police get prosecuted and stuff like that. But I think the community should just kind of understand what time we're in and know that there are other ways. You know, there's plenty of ways to scramble a leg. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, there's other ways we can do.
Yeah.
Things we can do to get justice.
Yeah.
And just to add to that, even before Sean Riggs, you know, thinking about just outside, you know, Roger Sylvester, all it takes is for one incident of something so traumatic and it spreads.
Mm.
It never leaves you. And if I go back, whether we have a conversation about, you know, how slavery has impacted on us, whether, you know, stories from the Caribbean, the stories of how my grandparents came here and were told, I can't say those words on radio, but whatever they were told by white people here, that trauma for me it's cumulative. And I think now that we're in 2019, coming to 2020, for me, I feel like we're only just coming to a point where we can openly talk about it.
Mm.
You know, I mean, of older generation, sometimes, you know, I love asking them questions to find out what their experience was. But oftentimes it's, I don't want to talk about it.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's an instant shutdown.
Mm.
And that for me can only speak about how traumatic that experience is. It passes on. I feel now in 2020, I feel that, and I say this from a sexual orientation perspective as well, we're now talking about this. Mm. And for me, that is the first step. The trauma will never leave us. I think I live in the UK. If I walk around thinking that equality is gonna, I'm hopeful for it, but
it's not going to happen. That's my perspective, whether it's right or wrong. I don't expect it. I can only live the life that I can. Mm. Be aware of it, share it with others, and where it's apparent, call it out. Mm. But unfortunately, I feel like we have to learn how to live and to cope with discrimination and the effects.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. One of the biggest things that gets discussed at Black Friday is the idea of resilience. So, for example, should we be teaching young people, young black children, to be more resilient? Mm. The problem with the idea of resilience is that you're just trying to toughen up people and telling them that, well, just take it. Just deal with it. Yeah. Just, you know what I mean? And maybe this hasn't helped us. So we at Black Five were trying to step away from the idea of resilience. And like Nathan has said, you know, we have to be more willing to deal with whatever's on the plate kind of thing. You know, not just where there is injustice, you know, put your hand up and say, look, this is wrong. But it's hard because, again, what is justice for me isn't justice for everybody else. And what you often find as well in some of these stories is that somehow people are very, very angry about a scenario. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to them, they actually don't have any actual connection to the scenario. So for example, people are very, very angry about Cherry Gross and what happened. Like, still, yet Lee Lawrence works in the Black Five building. And, you know, we talk and there's something's happening with him and the Cherry Gross Foundation. And, you know, they got some installation happening and he's quite upful about things. But you go outside, people are still angry. So there's this issue around, what justice is for one person and that justice for one person is not justice for everybody. And so there's a lot of I think ultimately in the community we need to talk more and we need to communicate better and just discuss whatever issues we're facing.
And also with that, I think that's a major thing about what this project is about, doing the focus groups, because we're talking about, we know what makes us angry, we discuss it, but a discussion that we don't always have is, well, how do we heal ourselves and what does healing look like? And if I had the choice, what would bring me to a place and a space of peace? And that's really what we're asking. We're giving people the opportunity to speak freely, to say, what does healing look like for them? What is it that ails them? And how can we support them? How can we empower the community? They're telling us what they want, and we're just here to just facilitate it and to bring it into being.
Mm-hmm. And what's been the response so far in terms of your initial engagement with young people? Are they happy to be part of that conversation, or is it, do you have to do a lot of legwork?
Well, it's always legwork, Patrick. Yes. It's always legwork. Come on.
It's been up and down. The next stage in terms of the project is we're going to start doing some individual interviews and start meeting young people where they are. Maybe it was a miscalculation for us to have this one place and expect people to come. But because, like I said, because of the serious youth issues, violence issues in the borough, we're moving forward, we are going to be going around talking to young black men in their own environments, wherever we can find them, you know. Mm. The project, ultimately, the idea of the project is, like Nathan said, is we're going to talk to these people and find out, from a preventative sense, what we can create, Black Thrive, SLAM, what we can create that will help them get involved with, not even get involved with services earlier, get them to just be a bit more aware about their own mental well-being and find ways of helping themselves so that they don't present so late in the system and then end up in, you know, acute services like is the current, I mean, that is one of the pipelines right now, you know, Section 136 and all of this stuff, which is a Mental Health Act and all this stuff. We want black boys in the borough of Lambeth to be a bit more aware of their mental well-being and a bit more understanding of ways that they can manage their mental well-being. And I think if that happens, then the project's a success, really and truly.
Mm. Nathan, tell me about the work that you're doing, particularly around young gay black men. What's your approach, and what's the issues, and are you hoping to bring gay and straight young black men together as part of this conversation?
I try.
In terms of major issues, just for time, I think some of them I've mentioned. A major thing is about social isolation and loneliness, and just those effects. We're talking about young people who haven't connected and know what older people have gone through. We're talking about mental health, sexual health as well. Just what that actually looks like, what a healthy sex life looks like. And I don't mean just, you know, how well you do it, but just your mental approaches, knowing about consent. Because I think there are things that we don't talk about in terms of older people taking advantage of those who are younger. We don't really have those conversations. But now we are. I guess I'm working with the NAS Project London as well, as well as collaborating with Black Thrive, SNAM. I do things in Southwark. Of course, working with Blackout UK and House of Rainbow, because I couldn't give... It's just such a massive picture. What I'm trying to do, firstly, is... And it's been really helpful, of course, working with SLAM, is to find out what the mental health needs are. What constitutes good mental well-being? And of course, hopefully we will be working and bringing everybody together in with Black Thrive. I think having those opinions all together is really, really important. I think just being with Black Thrive, it's really, really helped me to really, really understand. And I think it's likewise, I think it's probably been helpful for Black Thrive to hear the complexity of all of the different issues. We're talking about masculinity, femininity, what it means to be safe, what it means to, as I said, to be yourself, the differences around healthcare in terms of looking at services and seeing somebody who understands your experience, understands how your identity may shape your experience and also how others perceive you. Hopefully those are things that we can bring in, but it's massive. And as I'd say, just sexual health and HIV, just like with PrEP becoming so well known, I think that's been a massive, massive, massive product in relieving issues around anxiety and depression, as I spoke around having a healthy sex life.
Sure.
There really is so much.
Yeah.
Before you both go, it's been fascinating to hear you speak so openly about mental health, especially with black men, because I often feel like they're not included in conversations surrounding mental well-being. They're often sort of, you know, thought of, oh, they're strong, they can handle it. Mm-hmm. Look at them, they're so tall and muscular, they're all right. Mm-hmm. And I feel like people forget that black men can be very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, the pressures on their shoulders can be very, very high. And I feel like we need to have conversations like this much, much more. Before you go, though, where can our listeners reach you online if they want to get involved or if they want to attend one of your events or workshops? Where can they reach you?
Well, you can reach Black Thrive at www.blackthrive.org.uk. We've got a website, although it is coming down for like a couple of days, actually. And then it's coming back up again because we're changing hosting providers and all this good stuff. And, you know, I mean, people can get at me. I'm on Twitter and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. What's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is... I'm not even too sure. I think it's stharris316m. It's very long, but I've had Twitter for a very long time. Yeah. And you can catch me there, or you can email me at Siddiqui, that is Sadiki, at blackthrive.org.uk. And I'm only two days a week at Black Thrive, but I'm always available to, you know, I'm very passionate about this project because somebody gave me a paintbrush to paint on my landscape, which is Lambeth. I grew up here, you know, so I'm always available to message or whatever, or, you know, explain what Black Thrive's doing.
Yeah.
I love this stuff.
Okay, fantastic. And for you?
Very quickly, because I'm involved in a lot. So if you can contact me through Black Thrive and someone will get in touch with me. Alternatively, you can contact the NAS Project London. That's nas.org.uk. It's got on their website, and you'll just find details there to get through to me.
Fantastic.
I'm on LinkedIn. I am not on social media otherwise.
Oh, why are you not
for
on social media?
For my good mental health.
Leading by example.
Absolutely.
I don't want to be bombarded by fake images of this perfect life that doesn't really exist.
Oh. Yeah.
So I'd rather live in reality. Thank you.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us. Siddiqui Harris and Nathan Lewis.
And keep up the good work, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you.
Colourful.
Lambeth Mental Health Radio Show.
Colourful Radio.
We have a special guest in the studio, and I'm going to let him introduce himself.
Okay, my name is Stephen Rudder, and I have two roles. I'm an audiovisual artist, and I am also a psychotherapist.
Okay.
So, Stephen, I've known you for a while, particularly around your work as a psychotherapist. What are the key issues around black men and mental health in today, in 2020?
Well, I think that's a really broad question. But in terms of key issues, I think for me, it's really about their kind of engagement with the mental health services and the kind of disproportionate amounts of black men who are in mental health services, and also the kind of, I suppose, the channel into mental health services and what they're offered and what black men aren't offered, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So obviously you're a trained psychotherapist. It'd be interesting to know about your journey and how you decided to become a therapist.
Okay, well, I'm an artist, and so I was always interested in my organisation, my company is called Quiet Voice. So it's really into sort of highlighting voices which aren't heard. And obviously as a black man myself, that's often the experiences of black people. So I came across some statistics around black men and mental health, black people and mental health, and I wanted to do a piece of work. This was quite a few years ago. I wanted to do a piece of work about it. So I started kind of researching further, and I started really realizing, you know, the kind of disparity between, you know, how black men are overly represented in mental health services. And through the conversations I was having as well, I kind of realized, you know, the kind of treatment that black men have in mental health service, or some black men have in mental health services. So something about that kind of really got to me. And I felt quite frustrated for a while, and it was kind of knocking around in the back of my head. I couldn't find the money. No one would really give me the money to make the piece of work that I wanted. And it was something that was kind of knocking around in my head and in my heart, really, just to feel, well, you know, what can be done about it? Because I think so often we kind of feel, we can feel powerless, if you know what I mean. So it got to a point in my career that I felt, well, I wasn't really being satisfied by the work I was doing. I was doing some great work, which was commissioned work. But I felt I wanted to do stuff which was more more in line with my soul, if you like. So I started looking into the idea of training as a psychotherapist. And that went on for a couple of years. And I thought, well, if I had started already, then, you know, it's very expensive as well. But if I had started already, well, I would have actually got somewhere with it. So I started training. So I did a foundation at Birk Beck. And then I doing masters at Tavistock before I do my part 2 year.
Okay, great. And there are lots of black psychotherapists out there. Do you think black psychotherapists are taken seriously within mainstream mental health services around their practice? What's your perspective on that?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of, from my experience, there are men, but it's predominantly black women who make up like black psychotherapists. I think from my own experience, in terms of being taken seriously, I think, you know, for myself, I think it really comes down to what black people need, and that black psychotherapists have something to offer that maybe white psychotherapists don't. And I think that can sometimes be quite a kind of tetchy area. In terms of the need of black people, my opinion that the need of black people to have people of colour to be able to understand what their experiences are. And from my own experience, I mean, as part of your training, you have to have psychotherapy. And my desire was to have a black psychotherapist. And also in psychotherapy, you have something called supervision, where you talk around your patients and all that kind of stuff. And, and, you know, there's one occasion, just to give you an example, there's one occasion where we were talking around in supervision around the idea of whether or not black people need to have other black people giving them psychotherapy. And I don't think so all the time. It kind of depends on what's going on. But I think fundamentally, for myself, for instance, one of the things I did not want to do, and one of the reasons why I wanted a black therapist, is I did not want to explain what my my existence is. I didn't want to have to explain that or to prove it. And funny enough, at the time we were having the supervision, we were having this conversation, one of the other psychotherapists said, "Well, that's rubbish. You don't need to have a black psychotherapist." And I had to say to that person, "Well, actually, this is what's actually happening in this room is exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That you're not allowing me to express that this is my feeling and this is what I need." And that's exactly what I'm trying to avoid, which is why I, for instance, chose to go with a black psychotherapist.
Okay. So you want to tell us a bit about your art installation, because it focuses... It was shown at the Black Culture Archives. Why did you choose Black Culture Archives to have your installation? And what was the elements of how you developed that into a fantastic piece of art around black men and mental health?
Okay. Well, firstly, I really wanted to have the piece in a space. I wanted the piece to be seen. In its first iteration, I really wanted it to be seen, and I felt that I wanted black people to see it, because I thought it was a conversation that black people need to have. And in society generally, it's a wider conversation that people have to have. Do you know what I mean? Mental health services and so on. So Black Cultural Archives, who were really passionate about the project as well, offered me a space for a very small fee, offered me a space to use, and went... You know, really bent over backwards to kind of accommodate me and really support me in bringing it to the space. And also, you know, I suppose part of the reason why I had a small fee is because I really wanted it to be a free exhibition. I didn't want people to be held back from coming to the exhibition because they had to pay a small admission fee. So for me, I'd rather pay a small fee in order for people to see it, basically. And the process of developing the project, it was actually like a really long process. One of the things about the way that I work is I really want the people who it's based on to be really integral in the kind of development of the project. So we started the project working with a group of black men of different ages, which I kind of recruited through social media and through contacts I had in services and so on. And it was a group of, I suppose the biggest the group was about 12, and the smallest was probably about 5 or 6. So some people came in every so often and sometimes, but there was a core group of about 5 or 6. And we did a poetry workshop and a zine making workshop. So we got loads of National Geographic magazines, and we were really kind of encouraging them to work out their kind of symbolic associations around ideas of mental health. And this was around things like masculinity, social pressures, their experience of mental health service, their experience of psychosis. And we had a showcase of that. So they wrote this poetry. I was working with Richard McCloma, who's a poet as well. And so they wrote these poems, and we created a zine out of the collages. And from that first phase of the project, when that was finished, I took their poetry and their collages, and that informed the visual choices that I made, as well as the choices that I made in terms of developing the piece. And a lot of the men who were in those workshops, most of the men were interviewed whose voices were used, as well as other people who also had experience of mental health challenges as well.
So do you want to describe the installation, which I saw you kind of putting up together at the BCA? Can you use lots of imagery? You have screens, and obviously you've got the voices. What were you trying to depict through that? If we walk through the entrance of the exhibition, what was the message?
Well, the piece is called Black Men's Minds. Yeah. So really, it was about getting into the mind of various black men, and it's an immersive installation piece. So it has multiple projections, and it has these kind of screens which, when you project through it, it goes through and then goes onto the wall. So there's kind of a duplicity of kind of images as well. And there were three kind of projections. So what I was trying to do is that when people kind of walk into the space, they feel like they're coming into the mind of a black man, if you like. So you're hearing the voices of different black men talking about their experiences of social pressures, masculinity, the mental health services, and so on. But you're also seeing their symbolic associations, almost like a stream of consciousness, if you know what I mean. And the way that it's set up is so that there is a narrative screen, which is you see various black men's faces, and their eyes are kind of, there's like a letterbox over their eyes, and you see different images there. But also there's two other projections, and those ones are kind of more random. So it's kind of inviting the audience to make their own associations with what's being said. And yeah.
Get my voices on. I think it definitely started at around sixth form. A lot of things. Kind of like when I read them back to myself, a lot of things about my life didn't sound that great. Growing up without my father and going to an all-white secondary school.
I've got mumps, not being myself, and people ain't noticed. You're born in the UK, but you're being treated differently. You don't hear about white kids getting shot by police. You're not hearing about white kids getting racially abused and stopped and searched by the police and that. It can happen, but more time is often the black kids. Don't forget, you got guys on the road who've lost friends, who've lost family members, people close to them. Like, you know, you may have seen people getting killed or shot or whatever. You got youths out here who are actually struggling mentally, and people don't even notice it.
What it was, I believe, I was ignored for such a long time. All my issues was like, oh, it didn't even register with them.
So between 7 and 22, I had to deal with my psychosis by myself. But I didn't realise it was psychosis. I just thought it was my reality. But I got to see that it's a problem when they came for me.
Sounds very powerful. What's the public's reaction been to those who've attended your exhibition?
Yeah, overwhelmingly, people are really kind of affected by it and see that it's really powerful. I mean, it's not the most happy thing to go and see, if you know what I mean. But what people were saying was the importance of how this is something that needs to be spoken about. Do you know what I mean? And interestingly, for the last couple of days, I kind of stayed in the cafe area. And to sort of speak to people who are coming through. And I spoke to people, like I spoke to a young man who actually has been sectioned three times. And he was really inspired by the piece and kind of talking about his own experience and feeling so much benefit from actually kind of hearing that other people had the same experience or similar experiences as well. I heard from mothers who felt that they understood their children, their sons, better, if you know what I mean. So there was a whole range of kind of comments, but overwhelmingly people felt it was really powerful and really important, and a lot of people kind of sat and watched it like two or three times, because you can sit in different places and read it in different ways. So yeah.
Mm. That's great. And what are your plans for this installation? Is that BCA in Brixton? Have you got plans to show it again in South London or other parts of the country? What would be the ideal scenario for you?
Well, the ideal scenario is to show it in different places and different parts of the country, and that will happen eventually. Mm. I mean, obviously, these things cost a lot of money because it is an installation. You have equipment that you're bringing with you. There's setup costs. Mm. So it does cost a bit to kind of take around. Mm. BCA loved it and had such a had such an impact with their audience that we're in talks about maybe raising money together to be able to bring it back to the BCA. I've entered it into something in Australia of all places. For a science gallery.
Sure.
So it's really a question of now, you know, with these things you put so much time into it and so much energy into it that now it's done, it's like, okay, it's not like I've got a whole team of people that are kind of lining things up as you're doing it. I've got a very small team. The other thing is also we filmed the piece to give some kind of an impression of what the piece is, because people don't quite understand what it is until they go to it. People would open those doors and they'd go in and say, wow, they didn't know that's what it was. So now editing that piece means that you've almost got a calling card to say, okay, this is what the proposal is, this is what it looks like. So people seem to get more of an understanding of what they're going to bring to their venue.
Mm-hmm. Hearing you speak about your project, and that when you sort of walk in that room, you're sort of walking into the mind of what it's like to be a black man in Britain. Mm-hmm. What do you think the community can do to support black men in our community who may have mental health issues? What could we do as outsiders? I mean, I'm a black woman. I'm not a black man. I don't know what it's like to be a black man. I have brothers. I have a father. I have sons. I have a husband, but
even a co-host,
I would, yeah, and a co-host, yes, of course. But I would never ever know what it's like. And for me, it's like I always feel like I want to help, I want to be supportive, I love these men that are in my family, but sometimes it's very hard to sort of have conversations about your mental health. How are you feeling? Are you feeling down today? There seems to be like sort of like maybe a barrier. So what advice do you think you could give to somebody that could maybe help open up those doors?
Well, I mean, I think in the process that we went through, one of the things that kind of struck me was that it was myself and another black man who was facilitating the group. And when I say facilitating, it wasn't really a top-down thing, because we were all talking about our experiences as black men. And I think that, you know, sometimes with psychotherapy, and my experience of working with black men in psychotherapy is, for some black men, not all, but for some black men, it can be a very difficult thing to expose yourself and then feel vulnerable. Mm. I mean, in fact, I've had young black men, I work with Prince's Trust one day a week, and I've had young black men come to me the first time, and they come, and again, I'm not painting a brush for all black men, I'm just saying for some, they come and they might be dragging their feet, they're looking down, it's difficult to sort of get them to kind of engage. By the end of the process, they're looking in your eyes, they feel that they've kind of made a connection with you. But something happens between the first session and the second session, and that is that they go away and they feel something which maybe they're not used to feeling, and that is a vulnerability, that they've exposed themselves. So I think that when you have groups of black men talking about things together, then there's some kind of strength that people gain from that, understanding that there's other people that are going through a similar thing. And I think that's what this piece did for a lot of young black men. So in terms of yourself as a black woman, I'm not sure what I can say in terms of that. I mean, I think that there's one thing that we have to start thinking about, the range of images of black men that we have,
yeah,
and how we think of a black man.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that like when I go to the Caribbean, I feel like a king. I feel more at home Mm-hmm. And that's for Africa too. I feel more at home because you see that there are many different reflections of black men. In this country, it's very, very narrow.
It's like you're pressured to fit into a box.
Exactly.
Almost.
So I think that in some ways, as a community, we need to sort of think about ourselves more broadly in terms of what we can and what we can't do. And I've heard before, you know, this is black, this isn't black.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Mm. And that goes very strongly for this is a black man, this is what a black man should be. So I think that could be encouraged, particularly with young people, and also, you know, with our young men as well, just in terms of kind of thinking about what they're actually going through. It's touched on in the piece in terms of, you know, there's a lot of young black men who are seeing things that if it was their white counterpart, it would be, oh, poor you, you're experiencing this, this is terrible. Do you know what I mean? We need to get you help and support. But for young black men, it seems like it's, you're a thug.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? In some way you're used to this.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you, you know, this is part of your constitution, if you like.
It's the norm. You don't need help to recover from what you've just seen.
And this is trauma. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is trauma that you're experiencing. So I think that rather than sometimes looking at our young men and saying, we can't get through to them, it's a different generation. When I was a child, we need to start to understand that what they're going through is actually really traumatic, and that needs to be thought about as well.
Yeah,
mm.
Absolutely. Where can people reach you online if they're interested in following your journey and any other projects that you might have coming up, and if they want to get involved, where can they reach you?
Well, you can DM me on Instagram at Quiet Voice Picks, and that's Quiet Voice Picks. And Twitter, although I tend to be a bit more on Instagram, but Twitter is quite at Quiet Voice. Yeah.
Okay. And Patrick, any closing thoughts?
Not really. I mean, I think the only thing just to add, obviously, you're a therapist and an art practitioner, so you've got this unique roles. What more can be done to enhance the work, bringing therapy from a black perspective and art to either in terms of engagement, dialogue, and ultimately improving new ways of clinical engagement?
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting you say that, and I just talk about something else that I'm doing also. So I'm working on a project called Hood Mentality with young black men. And then we're using two streams, which is creativity and sport, to kind of inform and to help with well-being and mental health resilience as well.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about art, I think, is it's a way of expressing yourself. And I think that, and again, this is kind of touched on in the piece as well, that one of the issues that we have as black men and black people generally, and anyone really, is about not having the opportunity to be able to express yourself. And I'm not talking about drum music, I'm talking about like really express what's going on outside of the norm, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about creative expression is it offers you an opportunity to be able to do that, do you know what I mean? With the right steering, if you know what I mean. And sport also, there's something about sport that you can use sport in order to kind of build strength as well and enhance how you process things, how you use analogies. I mean, like, say for instance, the first 5 minutes of running, doesn't matter who you are, is like hell on earth. Do you know what I mean? And then you might get into your stride and it starts to get a little bit easier. Now that's life. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? When you start something, rather than giving up on something because it's hard at the beginning, realizing that it's the inertia makes it hard to get things started, but it will get better. Do you know what I mean? You can start using those kind of analogies to start helping people deal with their everyday lives.
Okay, fantastic. Now, I think we've run out of time, actually, Patrick.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. It's been really good speaking to you and hearing about how art can sort of get the message across about mental health in a way that maybe people who are not from the art world didn't really realise. Thank you for joining us. It's been very, very insightful. That is Stephen Rudder, who was talking about his exhibition that was at the BCA, which was about black men and their mental health. I'm Sinai Flary. My co-host is Mr. Patrick Vernon, and we have been discussing Black men and their mental well-being.
Colourful.
Lambeth Mental Health Radio Show.
Colourful Radio.